Early in the new year, we had what amounted to a royal visit. Hilary Stuyvesant had at last prevailed on Lorin to bring her to see the site. We had a week to prepare for the family. Hilary was bringing the elder children with her, and I was beside myself with excitement at the prospect of having all my favourite women at the City of the Moon. I left the search of the cliffs to Rell, while I rushed about rearranging the accommodation, checking our stores for such essentials as Coca-Cola and chocolates, commodities which make life bearable for Bobby Stuyvesant. They arrived in time for the lunch of cold meats and salads, which I had personally prepared, and immediately the visit began souring. Sally Benneter was not at the meal. She sent a message that she had a headache and was going to lie down. However, I saw her sneaking off with a towel and bathing costume towards the Emerald Pool. Eldridge Hamilton and Lauren Stuyvesant took one look at each other and remembered their last meeting. They were as hostile as a pair of rutting stags. I recalled Eldridge's boast that he'd sent Lauren packing. They began making elaborately offensive remarks at each other, and I was fully extended in trying to prevent actual physical violence breaking out. And when Eldridge spoke about people with more money than either breeding or sense, I thought I'd lost my expert on ancient writings. And as if this was not sufficient, it was also obvious that Hilary and Lorin were engaged in a domestic dispute which made it impossible for them to address each other directly. All communication was conducted through the agency of Bobby Stuyvesant, and was preceded by remarks of the order, "Please ask your stepmother if," or "if your father wants." Hilary wore dark glasses at the lunch table, and I could guess her eyes bore the traces of recent weeping. She was silent and reserved, as were both Ral and Leslie. The two youngsters were overcome with shyness in the presence of the Stuyvesants, and when Lauren and Eldridge also subsided into a smouldering truce, there were only two of us left articulate, Bobby Stuyvesant and me. Bobby took full advantage of the temporary breakdown in parental control to become an utterly impossible little bitch. She spent the entire meal either showing off shamelessly or being insolent to her stepmother. I would dearly have loved to turn her over my knee and paddle her stern. Immediately after the meal, dragged to its tortured conclusion, Eldridge retreated to his repository. Ral and Leslie muttered excuses and fled. Lurin asked me for the keys of the Land Rover, and I saw him take his shotgun and drive away towards the north, leaving Hilary and the children to me. I took Hilary through the Site Museum, and she soon forgot her unhappiness in the fascination of our exhibits. I had carefully cleaned and polished the great battle axe. It glittered silver, gold, and ivory, and we examined the craftsmanship of its manufacture together before going across to the repository of the scrolls. Sally was too busy to talk to us. She hardly lifted her head when we entered, but Hilary turned her gentle charisma onto Eldridge Hamilton, and he wasn't proof against it. When we left an hour later, Hilary had another devoted admirer. We went to the cavern and sat together above the Emerald Pool while the children splashed and shrieked in the cool green water. We talked together like old and dear friends, which we were. But even then it was some time before Hilary could bring herself to mention that which was troubling her. "Ben, have you noticed anything different about him?" The old question of an unhappy woman, and I made the old excuse for him. "He works so hard, Hill," and she snatched at it. "Yes, he's been tied up in this hotel business for months. He's building a chain of luxury vacation hotels across the islands of the Indian Ocean, the Comoros, Seychelles, Madagascar, 10 of them. He's exhausting himself." And then as we walked down towards the huts in the dusk, she said suddenly, "Do you think he has found another woman, Ben?" I was startled. "Good Lord, Hill. What on earth makes you think that?" "I don't know. Nothing, I suppose. It's just that..." And she stopped and sighed. "Where would he find more than he has now?" I asked softly. And she took my hand and squeezed it. "My dear Ben, what would we do without you?" When I went to tuck Bobby up and kiss her goodnight, I told her what I thought of her behaviour at lunch, and she snuffled a bit and said she was sorry. Then we kissed and hugged and agreed that we still loved each other. She was asleep before I'd switched out the light, and with dread in my heart, I went across to the common room for a repeat of the midday performance. At the threshold, I blinked with surprise. Lauren, Eldridge, and Sally were in a friendly and animated huddle over the typed pile of translation sheets, while Ral and Leslie were eagerly discussing their marriage plans with Hillary. The transformation was miraculous. I made my way with relief towards the Glen Grant bottle and poured a medium-sized one. "One for me also," Sally came across to me. I could see no evidence of headache. Her mouth was a hectic slash of bright lipstick, and the silk dress she wore was draped to expose her strong brown back and shoulders. She had piled her hair up on her head, and I thought I'd seldom seen her look so lovely. I poured her a drink, and we went to join the discussion of the scrolls. In contrast to his earlier mood, Lauren was at his most charming, and even Eldridge couldn't resist him. "Professor Hamilton has done a most remarkable job here, Ben," he greeted me. "I can only congratulate you on your choice of a colleague." Eldridge preened modestly. "There is something we cannot put off much longer, Ben," Lauren went on. "We're going to have to make an announcement soon. We can't keep this a secret much longer." "I know," I agreed. "Have you had any thoughts on it yet?" "Well, as a matter of fact..." I hesitated. I hate having to ask Lauren to spend money. "I was thinking of something on a rather grand scale." "Yes?" Lauren encouraged me. "Well, I thought if we could have the Royal Geographical Society convene a special symposium on African prehistory. Eldridge is a member of the council. I'm sure he could arrange it." We looked at him and he nodded. "And then perhaps Stuyvesant International could play host to the delegates. Fly them to London, pay their expenses to make sure they all attend, or at least some of them." Lauren threw his head back and laughed delightedly. "You are a scheming son of a gun, Ben. I see your plan exactly. You're going to get all your critics and enemies together in one bunch within the hallowed precincts of the RGS, and you are going to play the Al Capone of archaeology in a scientific St. Valentine's Day massacre. In the jargon, you're going to moiter the bums. That's right, isn't it?" I blushed at having my plan so readily exposed. "Well," and then I grinned sheepishly and added, "I guess that's about it, Lo." "I love it," Sally clapped her hands with delight. "We'll draw up a guest list." "Yeah, we'll do this in style," Lorraine promised. "We'll fly them in first class and put them at the Dorchester. We'll give a champagne lunch to lull them, and then we'll turn Ben and Eldridge loose amongst them like a pack of ravening wolves." He'd entered fully into the spirit of the thing, and he turned to Eldridge. "How long would it take to arrange?" "Well, it would have to go before the council for approval. We would have to give them some idea of the agenda, but of course, your offer to pay the expenses would make it a lot easier. I'll lobby a couple of the other council members." Eldridge was enjoying it also. There is a rather perverse thrill to be had out of planning and executing the professional assassination of one's enemies. "I think we could arrange it for April." "April the 1st, I suggested. "Yeah, lovely," laughed Lauren. "We must have Wilfred Snell," Sally pleaded. "Oh, he's top of the list," I assured her. "And that slimy little Rogers, and Davalos." We were still gloating and scheming when we sat down to eat the fiery curry of wild pheasant that I hoped would make the sultry night air seem cool by comparison. There were pitchers of cold draught beer to go with it, and the meal developed into a festive occasion. We were still gloating on the discomfort of our scientific enemies and planning the confrontation in detail, when Sally turned suddenly to Hillary, who'd been sitting quietly beside me. You must forgive us, Mrs. Stuyvesant. This must be terribly boring for you. I don't suppose a word of it makes sense to you. Sally's tone was honeyed and solicitous. I was as surprised as Hilary, for I understand enough of the secret language of women to recognize this as an open declaration of war. I hoped that I was mistaken. But 5 minutes later, Sally attacked again. You must find the heat and primitive conditions here most trying, Mrs. Stuyvesant. Not the sort of weather for your tennis parties, is it? The way she said it made tennis seem the pastime of a spoilt and ineffectual social butterfly. But this time, Hilary was ready for her. And, with a face like an angel and tones every bit as sugary as Sally's, she ripped back in a devastating counterattack. I'm sure it can be most unhealthy, especially after any length of time, Dr. Benita. The sun can play havoc with one's skin, can it not? And you're still looking peaky from your headache. We were very worried about you. I do hope you're feeling better now. Sally found that, despite her gentle, nun-like air, Hilary was an opponent worthy of her steel. She changed her attack. She turned all her attention onto Lauren, laughing gaily at his every word and not taking her eyes from his face. Hilary was helpless in the face of these tactics. I seemed to be the only one in the party aware of this duel in progress, and I sat silently trying to puzzle out the meaning of it all, until Hilary played her trump. Lauren, darling, it's been such a busy, exciting day. Won't you take me to bed now, please? She swept off the field on Lauren's arm, and reluctantly I had to admit that my Sally had received the treatment she deserved. I woke to the awareness of somebody else in my bedroom with me, and I tensed myself for sudden, violent action as I rolled my head stealthily and looked towards the door. It was open. The moonlight outside was bright and clear. Sally stood in the opening. She wore a flimsy nightdress, which did not conceal the lovely outline of her nude body against the silver moonlight. The long legs, the swelling womanly hips, the nipping of waist and flare of breast, and the long gazelle neck with tilt of dainty head. "Ben," she said softly. "Yes?" I sat up and she came quickly to me. "What is it, Sal?" In reply, she kissed me with open mouth and probing tongue. I was taken completely by surprise, frozen in her arms, and she laid her cheek against mine. In a small, gusty voice, she whispered, "Make love to me, Ben." There was something wrong here, desperately wrong. I felt no awakening of desire, only a warm rise of compassion for her. "Why? Why, Sal?" I asked. "Why now?" "Because I need it, Ben." "No, no, Sally, I don't think you do. I think that is the very last thing in the world you need now." And suddenly she was crying, big, broken, silent sobs. She cried for a long time, and I held her. When she was quiet, I laid her on the pillow and covered her with the blankets. "I am a bitch, aren't I, Ben?" she whispered, and went to sleep. I stayed awake all that night, watching over her. I think I knew then what was happening, but I did not want to admit it to myself. At breakfast, Lauren abruptly announced that the family would return immediately to Johannesburg, rather than stay the extra day as had been originally planned. I found it hard to hide my disappointment, and when I asked Lauren for a reason, as soon as we were alone, he merely looked towards the heavens and shrugged with exasperation. "You're plain lucky you never married, Ben. My God, women!" Life at the City of the Moon returned to its normal, satisfying routine for a week, during which Ral and I pursued our search for the tombs, and the others worked steadily at the scrolls. Then, while Ral and I sat in a sizzling midday sun under the meagre shade of a camel thorn, a little puckish figure rose from the grass, seemingly at my feet. "Sunbird," said Chai softly, "I have travelled many days to seek the sunshine of your presence." He turns the prettiest compliment, and my heart went out to him. "Ral," I said, "let me have your tobacco pouch, please." We sat together all that afternoon under the camel thorn, and we talked. The conversations of primitive Africa are an art form, with elaborate rituals of question and answer, and it was late before Chai reached the subject which he had come to discuss. "Does Sunbird remember the water in the rock at the place where we slew the elephant?" Sunbird remembered it well. "Does Sunbird remember the little holes that the white ghosts made in the rock?" Sunbird would never forget them. "These holes gave Sunbird and the big golden one much pleasure, did they not?"
"They did indeed."
"Since that day, I have looked with fresh eyes upon the rocks as I hunted." "Would Sunbird wish to visit another place where there are many such holes?"
"Would I?"
"I will lead you there," Chai promised.
"And I will give you as much tobacco as you can carry away," I promised him in return. And we beamed at each other.
"How far is this place?" I asked. And he began to explain. It was beyond the big wire, he told me. This was the 300-mile-long game fence along the Rhodesia border, which was erected to control movements of the wild animals as a precaution against foot-and-mouth disease. We would need clearance from the Rhodesians. And when Chai went on to describe an area which seemed fairly close to the Zambezi River border with Zambia, I knew I would have to ask Lorin to arrange an expedition. It was obviously squarely within the zone of terrorist activity. Chai refused to accompany back to camp, which was filled with his traditional enemies, the Bantu. Instead, we arranged to meet under the camel thorn 3 days later, once Chai had completed the rounds of his trap line. I was fortunate enough that evening to find Lorin had returned an hour before from Madagascar. "What's the trouble, Ben?" His voice boomed above the radio static. "No trouble, Lo. Your little bushman friend has found another ancient gold-working site. He's happy to take me to it." "That's great, Ben. The elephant mine is in production already, and looking very good indeed." "There's only one problem, Lo. It's in Rhodesia, in the closed area." "No problem, Ben. I'll fix it." And the following evening we spoke again. "It's all set up for Monday week. There'll be a Rhodesian police escort to meet us at the Punda Matenga border gate." "Us?" I asked. "I'm stealing a couple of days off, Ben. Just couldn't resist it. You take the bushman with you, go by Land Rover through to Punda Matenga, and I'll come in from Bulawayo by helicopter. See you there Monday week." "Morning. Okay?"